You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome back. If you're rejoining us, happy Tuesday afternoon. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Folks, if you've been listening to the show, you know that last week and the week before, I've tried to talk about the Epstein files and the scandal that keeps on rolling in the context of those that were targeted, those that were victimized by Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, and to try to refocus our attention on what continues to permit, what is in our institutions and in our structures and in our culture that makes violence against women, especially intimate partner violence, as well as the broader problem of human trafficking, so pernicious and so persistent and so hard to uproot and combat. I'm really pleased and humbled to be joined this afternoon by an expert in these matters. She is Marielle Barnes. She's a professor and assistant professor of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies forms of everyday kind of violent experiences that women experience in intimate partnerships and the relationship between gender and institutions. So really happy to have her here. She is also a core faculty member at UW-Madison of Madison's Sexual Violence Research Initiative, which is an interdisciplinary group that's really focusing on these issues. So welcome to the program, Marielle. I really appreciate you being here. Let's establish a baseline just in the category of sexual violence and intimate partner violence, because I think many people have a somewhat limited notion of what that is. Could you help? Let's just start with a basic definition of terms and what are we talking about here?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Maggie. I'm really glad to be here talking about this. So to define kind of intimate partner or what I call everyday violence, I would say these are forms of violence, and they're not just physical or sexual. They can be a whole range of like financial, economic, emotional, psychological, stalking. They're kind of violence that happens, you know, every day or in the normal course of people's lives. And I'll say women because the majority of victims are women, like 9 out of 10 victims. And so they're kind of these forms of violence that a lot of the times we don't kind of notice, I think. With Epstein, obviously, he's a very prominent, very high profile, or he was a very high profile person. And so there's been a lot of attention around that. But those kinds of, let's say, incidences of violence, I think, are more rare when we consider like the totality of violence against women that happens in our society.
One of the things that I find both troubling about the Epstein case and perhaps even an important opportunity that it represents is wealth and acute power asymmetries allow abuse on scale or at scale, and it becomes replicable. And that's what you see in the Epstein case and the Epstein scandal. But again, that's at scale due to wealth, power, and access. The reality is it's a tiny fraction of the overwhelming amount of violence against women that is occurring, as you put it, Professor, on a daily basis. What is it in culture, specifically American culture, and is there a different point? Are we in a different cultural moment? I've heard many women and many advocates saying that there is so much toxicity and so much of a regression into what I'm going to call big time gender stereotypes. Again, very regressive, where it seems to be, especially from the right, encouraging men to adopt a very aggressive posture towards women and encouraging women to effectively take a submissive posture, and what this could be doing to the already overwhelming problem of sexual violence against women in this country. Your thoughts, Professor?
Yeah, I think that's right. I wouldn't say it's just a US problem. I think this is a global problem, and at the heart of it is misogyny and patriarchy. that are causing this. And it's this hatred of women. And I often think that misogyny is one of like the easiest kind of hate ideologies to adopt, because it can be anything from like, you know, locker room jokes that people always tell, or like vague sexism, but it often like progresses from there, right? The other thing I study is the manosphere, which is this kind of toxic masculinity ideology that's kind of emerging that you hinted at. And I think in this particular moment, particularly since COVID, we've seen this increase in violence against women. We can see that like in homicides and femicides that are happening. So I know in, I think it was 2022, like Wisconsin had, I think it was 96 homicides related to domestic violence, which was has been constantly increasing since about 2020. And to kind of put that in perspective, like a lot of times people say like, oh, well, Wisconsin's a special case because we're so rural and like, there's lots of suicide and homicide in rural kinds of areas because farmers are struggling. But Minnesota, which is just across the border, which would be like our closest kind of neighbor or comparator, had, I think, about 24 in the same year. So there's something happening, I think, in Wisconsin, in American society more generally, but also across the world, to see this kind of increase in violence. And I think you're right to say that people in power a lot of the time have been pushing this kind of anti-women, anti-feminism, anti-gender equality agenda.
Yeah, it's a disturbing moment. I hear again from women, and especially women that interact with immigrant communities, as well as women of color, that are particularly concerned that in effect, the threat level has gone up a goodly amount, a substantial amount, since the rise of MAGAism and Donald Trump, and certainly with the beginnings of his second term, that rhetoric has, if anything, sort of been amplified and is accelerating. I want to talk a little bit about the systems and the systemic failures that at least we've had reporting in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about women that have come to law enforcement and said, help me, I am in this situation, and been turned away, in fact, been made fun of. There seems to be a system failure, both a what are the laws that address this, especially when it comes to stalking? What is the relationship, and how do our police react to issues related to and complaints of domestic violence? Walk us through, Professor, some of the systemic issues that prevent us as a society from really making inroads to reduce intimate partner violence.
Yeah, so I think attitudes of law enforcement is definitely one. It's certainly better than it was. Like, I have talked to police and law enforcement and prosecutors, you know, who used to be working in the 80s and 90s, and there, at that time, it would have been like, you separate the different parties, you tell them to calm down, and they all go back into the house together. And so it's not quite that bad anymore, but there's still a lot of disbelief, I think. And when women report, oftentimes they're not believed, or it's not seen as violence. So I used to work as an advocate on a domestic violence hotline, talking to people. I remember hearing stories about like abusers sending their victims flowers, and the flowers ending up on the doorstep. And the victim had requested like no contact. They had a protective order in place, and they would report these flowers to the police, and the police would say, oh, they're trying to say sorry, like they're apologizing. And what the flowers are not an apology. The flowers are the abuser saying, I know where you are and I can get to you at any time, right? And it's this kind of control. And having people or having law enforcement like not follow that up and not enforce the protective order in place is a problem. The other thing that I would say that's happening in this current moment is lack of funding. And given to different organizations who are helping victims of violence. So, and this has been happening not just during the Trump administration, but during the Biden administration as well. The big one most recently was what we call the VOCA cuts. And so VOCA is the Victims of Crime Act. And under this act, white collar crime and penalties and fines are put into a fund essentially that is then dispersed by the federal government to states that is then dispersed to people working with victims of violence. The problem is that this fund, the amount in this fund is getting smaller and smaller and smaller over time. And so they've cut the amount that is dispersed from that fund. In some cases in Wisconsin, I think we were facing a 60% cut in funding from that fund. And I know some organizations, some domestic violence organizations, were losing 80% or more of their funding. And so they're thinking, like, we can't keep a shelter open anymore, or if we do, we can't keep it open for 24 hours. You know, we can't provide the level of advocacy and service. You know, if we do court accompaniment, maybe we cut that. And so there's these kind of cascading failures, right? Mm-hmm. And then in the current moment, we've also had the Trump administration put forward a number of executive orders which have had consequences for funding. So the federal DOJ Office for Victims Violence Against Women like shut down their granting process for a couple months, and so no money was coming out of that. Or a lot of organizations are having trouble about how they need to comply with some of the federal government executive orders, but also comply with like HUD regulations, right? So one of the things is you need to take gender identity into account when providing HUD funding, because you don't want, you know, boys and girls, they each need to have their own room a lot of the time past a certain age. But you're not allowed to do that under the current executive orders. So there's this kind of tension about what to do and how to go about it and how to disperse funds to the people who need it the most.
Yeah, when talking about gender-based violence, it's a little bit difficult to do so if you can't talk about gender or you can't make any reference to gender in the sorts of ways that you and I are discussing. I have worked with some of those nonprofits trying to make sense of what is nonsense. Again, my opinion, not my special guest. Her name is Mariel Barnes. She's an assistant professor of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She focuses on sexual violence, and she's a core faculty member of UW-Madison's Sexual Violence Research Initiative, which is an interdisciplinary group designed to investigate the psychological, societal, and policy aspects of sexual violence. We're not going to be able to get into this, but I want for our listeners and for you to start thinking about how economic vulnerabilities make women and young women especially, again, perfect targets for sexual violence or predators like Jeffrey Epstein, and why the funding from VOGA, the violence, what was the acronym again, Mariel?
Victims of Crime Act.
Victims of Crime Act, why that funding is so essential, because in order to get people out of that cycle, oftentimes there are substantial economic obstacles. We're going to talk about those intersections, and then, of course, what can we do about it? What can you do about it? What should we be asking our elected officials to do when we come back with our special guest, Professor Mariel Barnes of the University of Wisconsin-Madison? I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Back, everyone. Welcome if you're just joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got a special guest with us for this half hour. Her name is Mariel Barnes. She's an assistant professor of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where her research focuses on using a mixed methodology approach to look at aspects of sexual violence or intimate partner violence. Thanks again, Professor, for being with us. I wanted to talk a bit about the intersection of sexual or intimate partner violence and economic vulnerabilities, and the Victims of Crime Act and that funding source is an element of the solution, but it points and highlights really the economic obstacles for women that are trying to get out of these sorts of relationships. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so economics is really, really important. One of the biggest barriers to leaving an abusive relationship is a lack of housing and the fear that you're going to be homeless. So I am part of an evaluative study looking at Wisconsin's pilot program on domestic violence housing first. And so this is the idea that if you provide women with housing or rental assistance, you will remove them from their situations. And we are seeing great results with that. And we're seeing that it works, because what do you do if you're being abused and you have nowhere to go? Like, yes, you could go to shelter, but shelter is not a permanent process. And oftentimes shelters are full, particularly if you have kids, because there's not enough beds and there's not enough services in Wisconsin right now. And so having somewhere safe to go that your abuser doesn't know about, that is the right size for your family, is really, really important, where you can pay your utilities. I was traveling up north as part of the project, and we were taken to past a house that didn't have any electricity, not because the utilities weren't paid, but because it didn't have a hookup. And this was suggested by someone, not with the organization, but someone in the community, as a place where women who are trying to leave an abusive relationship could go and be safe. And it's like, they cannot go there, right? You cannot live in the 21st century without electricity. That's just not okay in modern day America. So economics is a big factor. A lot of the time what we see is also transportation is a big problem. And so even if you live in Milwaukee, where, you know, you have buses and things like that, getting to a job is really, really hard. And you need to get to a job in order to pay for your rent, pay for your food, support your family. And if you can't transport yourself, that's a huge problem. And this is also particularly a concern in rural areas, where you might have to go like a long way to get to your job. And so providing that support, particularly for, you know, housing, transportation, that's the kind of assistance that VOCA could often be used for, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly when it was given to a domestic violence organization, that's what they would spend it on a lot of the time. Or they'd spend it on like advocacy services, so actual advocates help doing the work and the legwork to help women get those things. So economics plays a huge role in helping people leave. The other thing I would say about that is, like, people often forget about financial abuse, and that's really, really common. So, like, either, you know, you work a job, but your partner takes all your money, or you're not allowed to work a job, or your partner has run up huge amounts of debt in your name and trashed your credit, or you've been evicted before and there's been damage because of the violence that you've been, you know, from your partner. And so that's now on your record, and that makes it harder to, like, get another house, get another job, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's this kind of vicious cycle.
Again, folks, if you're just joining us, we have Assistant Professor Mariel Barnes of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's one of the core faculty members of their sexual violence research initiative. I want to talk about what can people do about this. I know that there are men of good faith out there of all political persuasions that find this abhorrent, that are shocked by it, that are disgusted by the rates of this sort of sexual violence against women and the incidence of human trafficking. What can a regular person, especially some of our male allies out there, but just all of us in our collective day-to-day lives, do about this? And what should we be asking our elected officials to do about this?
Yeah. I think the most important thing is recognizing, first of all, that it's happening, and asking people if they need help. So you don't need to confront the abuser and, like, threaten to, like, beat them up or stuff like that. That can often make the situation worse for victims. But if you suspect someone is being abused, like, offering help, telling them that you will be there, telling them that you will support them, they can come to you at any time. That's the other thing about being in this kind of situation. It often takes multiple times to leave a situation. I think the average, the figure that's thrown around is 7. And so a lot of people get kind of tired of, like, victims going back to their abuser, but just letting them know that when they are ready, you will be there to help them can be really important. In terms of elected officials, like, writing to them, letting them know that they should support this. It was very heartening in the Wisconsin budget that just got passed. The legislature allocated $66 million to make up for that VOCA shortage, so that's great. but more needs to be done. We need to apply pressure to our elected officials.
Folks, that's Assistant Professor Mariel Barnes. Mariel, would you be willing to come back sometime and talk about the things like what happened with the Iowa shooting victims at schools and this very particular issue of gentlemen generically referred to as incels and the intersection with media, because that's a pernicious problem as well. We really appreciate your time, Professor. Folks, I'm Maggie Dawn. When we come back, I'll break down the Epstein timeline and why this hypocrisy is so unacceptable. Don't go anywhere. There's a link to Green Bay and some breaking news this afternoon that involves the GOP party up there. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. And welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Some breaking news today out of Green Bay. Reporting by the Green Bay Press Gazette that a Sturgeon Bay man was charged 5 days ago with possession of child pornography after law enforcement say that they found images of child abuse and bestiality uploaded to his IP address. The who here matters. The man who was charged is a gentleman by the name of Scott Susek. He's 56-year-old, again, of Sturgeon Bay. And his wife, Stephanie Susek, is the chair of the Republican Party of Door County and the former chair of the 8th Congressional District GOP. And here's where it gets really awkward and very confusing. Apparently, on July 15th, 2009, 16 years ago, an investigator from the Door County Internet Crimes Against Children Division interviewed Susek and reported that he admitted then, 16 years ago, to downloading child pornography. The Sturgeon Bay police officer investigating Susek in 2025, this present, most recent investigation, wrote that, quote, it remains unclear as to why the 2009 case was not referred to the Door County District Attorney's Office for prosecution. Again, why did that happen? In other words, why did no prosecution happen some 16 years ago? And apparently this guy, maybe he took a break, but apparently he's found his way to continue to commit these kinds of very heinous crimes. Apparently in this most recent charge, more than 300 images of child abuse material were uploaded by Susek's IP address on March 12th, including bestiality. This is disgusting. And again, his wife, chair of the Republican Party of Door County, someone put that information out onto Twitter or Instagram, and immediately Joel Kitchens, who is the Republican representative from Sturgeon Bay, so a member of the assembly, took up to defend Stephanie Susek and replied, I believe, to this post on Facebook, a Facebook post that, quote, Representative Kitchens knows Stephanie and believes 100% that she knew nothing about it, saying she is a wonderful person. I hope you will show some compassion and try to imagine what she is going through right now. Again, 16 years, he admitted to it back in 2009. Representative Kitchens, when we're talking about child porn in the era of Epstein, you might want to take a pause. Maybe not jump to the defense of Mrs. Susek, and wait until the investigation proceeds. Just disgusting, disgusting. And again, all of this happening under this cloud of deep hypocrisy from Donald Trump and the entire MAGA movement as it relates to Jeffrey Epstein and the files. I've heard the rebuttals from Republicans. Why didn't Joe Biden release the files? This was not something that Joe Biden or Democrats ever ran for president or any other elected office on. It was the purview of the MAGA movement and Donald Trump. It was Donald Trump not Joe Biden, back in 2015 that made suggestions that Bill Clinton was criminally implicated by the Epstein files. And this was during, of course, Donald Trump's campaign against the Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. That's what he insinuated back in 2015. Of course, the QAnon conspiracy then took off during Donald Trump's presidency. What was the QAnon conspiracy garbage basically rooted in? The number one conspiracy theory that it based its existence on was freaking Pizzagate, the idea that Democrats and only Democrats were engaging in this global ring of human and child trafficking and sacrifice based out of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. It was so incredibly provoking to people that a swarm of people showed up at this arcade slash pizza parlor demanding to see the basement. And there was no basement. And this continued on and on and on for years, whether we're talking about Dan Bongino or Kash Patel or Trump himself, constantly fanning the flames of the QAnon conspiracy Pizzagate theory, insinuating at all times that it is Democrats and only Democrats that would be implicated if these files were released, and insinuating some effort at cover-up. Again, this has been the talking point from the right, from virtually everyone surrounding Donald Trump. Did they never think this moment would come? It's not like they didn't know that there aren't hundreds of photographs spanning some 15 plus years of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein together. They missed the moment when Donald Trump wished Ghislaine Maxwell well back in 2020, a convicted child sex trafficker. He wished her well. Again, what is even going on here? This goes back to, of course, recent statements by J.D. Vance, 2021 and in 2023, and Donald Trump Jr. in 2023, saying these things, what's in the file, and making an affirmative case for Donald Trump's reelection because he would release the Epstein files. And of course, Donald Trump denying earlier this month that he appeared in the Epstein files. And then reporting from the Wall Street Journal just days ago that Pam Bondi directly told the president back in May that he's in these files. Well, Jacob and Jamie did some work for us this afternoon and put together some large cuts. You'll recognize the voices here that take us through some of this chronology. Let's start with that first one, Jacob. Let's take a listen.
But I don't understand why the Jeffrey Epstein case would be of interest to anybody. It's pretty boring stuff. It's sordid, but it's boring. And I don't understand why it keeps going. I think only pretty bad people, including fake news, want to keep something like that going.
It's a very delicate subject, but we should put everything out there and let the people decide it. I mean, the White House and the White House team are privy to facts that I don't know. I mean, this isn't my lane. I haven't been involved in that. But I agree with the sentiment that we need to put it out there.
I do know that the Epstein files are in the custody of the Biden administration. You know, I don't know to what extent they've added or deleted things. It's kind of amazing now. Democrats who did not want them released, now they want them released. So again, I'm a little concerned about chain of custody. I don't know anything about it. I'm as curious as anybody else.
I've said it. Dan Bongino said it. We've reviewed all the information, and the American public is going to get as much as we can release. He killed himself.
Unbelievable amount of charges they've tried to file against the president. I'm sure this would be handled the exact same way. What we're simply wanting to do here is give them cover.
What did she tell you about the review? And specifically, did she tell you at all that your name appeared in the file?
No. She's given us just a very quick briefing. And in terms of the credibility of the different things that they've seen,
that is incredible. Again, that was Senator Mark Wayne Mullen admitting that they're trying to provide cover for Donald Trump. Why would Donald Trump have anything to fear from a special prosecutor or any investigation or release of files if there's nothing there? what's the deal? Oh, wait, maybe he knows that his own party invents stuff out of thin air and lies about it for years and years and years and tries to make something out of nothing, and that now his base has been activated under this particular file. So any mention of Donald Trump, which has to be probably pretty frequent since he was on his plane, Jeffrey Epstein's plane, at least 8 times, according to the manifests and other reporting. Yeah, kind of hard to put this genie back in the bottle, the toothpaste back in the tube, after you fanned the flames for years and years, if not decades. Of course, Donald Trump said in June 2024, during the heat of the campaign, that he would release the Epstein files. That was in an interview with Rachel Campos Duffy. Yes, that Duffy, wife of now Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, on Fox News, said he would release the files. QAnon believers voted for Trump by a margin of 61 percentage point. It was a core element of his coalition. Pam Bondi said in November, right after the election, that there is, quote, no legal basis to keep the names in the Jeffrey Epstein documents private. That was in November. In January of this year, Kash Patel vowed to release the files and expose Jeffrey Epstein's connections. I will do everything, if confirmed as FBI director, to make sure the American public knows the full weight of what happened in the past and how we are going to countermand missing and exploited children going forward. In February, Pam Bondi hyped the release of the Epstein binders, which turned out to be an entire nothing burger once they were eventually released. And then in March, because of the outrage over the Epstein binder nothing burger in February, told Fox News that the FBI was working, quote, around the clock in 12-hour overnight shifts to get further evidence ready for release. She told Fox Business she relieved a truckload of unreleased documents. In May, she insisted that the FBI was reviewing tens of thousands of videos with children or child porn. And of course, again, based on reporting from the Wall Street Journal, it was also in May when Bondi told Trump he's in the Epstein files. And of course, don't forget the Epstein-Trump feud in early June. Remember when Epstein tweeted out, mark this post for the future, the truth will come out, at real Donald Trump is in the Epstein files. That was June 5th. And on June 6th, Kash Patel, this is cut 19, Jacob, cut 19, Kash Patel on the Joe Rogan Experience said, yep, we're going to release these files. Let's take a listen.
I don't have that one.
Oh, that's too bad. We've
it's
got
in the
it.
Super clip. Look,
yes, well, it's it. That was part of that supercut. Do we have time for that second supercut? We do not. We're going to take that when we come back because, again, the hypocrisy here is stunning. Donald Trump saying this is boring. Only bad people are talking about it. His tweets disparaging his base. What happened to release the files? What happened to running on this in June of 2024? What happened to draining the swamp? This is insane. This is hypocrisy at the highest levels. We'll talk more about what this means for Wisconsinites, especially given the revelations of the charges relating to child pornography coming out of Green Bay. That defendant with connections to the Green Bay, excuse me, the Door County Republican Party chair. This discussion continues on the other side. What's it all mean for Wisconsin? We discuss next right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. We have some breaking news related to the continuing Epstein scandal that plagues the Trump administration literally at every turn. I had been going through the timeline of the Trump administration and Donald Trump's flip-flop, and again, Kash Patel and Dan Bongino apparently completely abandoning Epstein, everybody, including Speaker Mike Johnson, eventually saying Americans should just move on, despite the fact that this has always been a centerpiece of the MAGA movement, not just about human trafficking or the abuse of children, but specifically the Epstein files. Again, when you go back to early July, the nothing burger and then the announcement from the DOJ that the Epstein investigation was closed, there's no more forthcoming. The response from the MAGAverse was swift and clear. They were displeased, and all polling to date indicates that across all party affiliation, Americans are deeply dissatisfied with Donald Trump's handling of this matter. He has tried repeatedly to end discussion of this matter, calling it boring, telling people he's been dead a long time, let's move on, and yet reporting still pouring out. Wired Magazine reporting on July 15th that 3 minutes were cut out of Jeffrey Epstein's prison video surrounding the time that he allegedly committed suicide. Donald Trump then responding, I don't know why we're still talking about this. The House then voted to release the Epstein files on July 15th, only to be stymied by Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson then concluding the House's term to avoid another vote to compel the release of the files. All this time, Donald Trump becoming more and more unhinged. Then yesterday, Donald Trump changing his excuse, his reason for ending his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. There's lots in this cut. This is yesterday, and then we're going to give you the breaking news cut that just dropped moments ago. Listen to Donald Trump. Remember, for years, the line from Donald Trump has either been, Jeffrey Epstein and I got into a dispute over purchasing the same real estate parcel, and or he was inappropriate towards a club member's daughter at Mar-a-Lago, and he was a creep, so I kicked him out. But yesterday, Donald Trump changed his story on Epstein yet again. Let's take cut 24.
The ad is playing before the cut starts.
No, I'm not talking about the YouTube cut. I'm talking about cut 24 that we already have in the hopper. This is Trump, his excuse yesterday, the new excuse about his... Okay, let's wrap that clip. Let's wrap that clip. That was a new excuse. He stole personnel. Today, Donald Trump asked about that, asked about who specifically was Donald Trump upset that Jeffrey Epstein had stolen from Donald Trump. Donald Trump admitting that one of those individuals may be Virginia Guifra, one of Epstein's victims who testified against Epstein. Let's take that cut now. This is breaking news, absolutely astonishing admission from the President of the United States that he was concerned about Jeffrey Epstein stealing, this is the president's language, Virginia Guifra and other members of the team that worked in Donald Trump's spa at Mar-a-Lago. Let's take a listen. No, sir. We don't know because you haven't released the Epstein files. Absolutely stunning admissions from the president of the United States that he didn't end his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein because he was a creep. He didn't end it because he ultimately was charged and criminally convicted for sex trafficking. No, 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 no. He cut off his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein because Jeffrey Epstein, quote, stole people that worked in Donald Trump's spa, apparently including Virginia Guifer or Guffrey, depending on who's pronouncing it. That young woman ultimately committed suicide. She killed herself. She was one of Jeffrey Epstein's most outspoken accusers. The next 24 hours is probably going to be wild, ladies and gentlemen, but I don't know about you. This is just disgusting, including the way in which Donald Trump spoke about the people that worked for him. People aren't stolen, sir, unless they're property. Tells you a bit about the mindset of this president. We'll discuss more as the news unfolds. Thanks for being with me this afternoon discussing these challenging topics. What does this mean for Wisconsin? I think Wisconsinites aren't going to put up with this. A clear vulnerability for Republicans here in the state. Let's have transparency and accountability, shall we? I'm Maggie Dawn. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.